Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today for our Zoom event. This one I'm really looking forward to in particular. We have a wonderful friend and a past president of our chapter who's graciously agreed to sit for an interview and discuss his time as a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So let me just explain the format that we're going to have for today's event. I will be interviewing Justice Daniel Kelly throughout the hour-long program. During this time, you can send questions to me using the Q&A feature at the bottom of the screen. Just click on that, type in your question. I will try to get to as many of them as possible, but feel free to send those questions to me throughout the interview. So I'm going to briefly introduce Justice Kelly, although no doubt everyone is familiar with him. But Justice Kelly is a graduate of Carroll College, now Carroll University, the Regent University Law School, where he was editor-in-chief of the Law Review. Following law school, he clerked both at the Wisconsin Court of Appeals and the U.S. Court of Federal Claims. Justice Kelly had a decorated career in private practice before joining the bench. Although he focused primarily on commercial litigation, Justice Kelly developed criminal and trial experience representing individuals in both misdemeanor and felony cases. Justice Kelly gained valuable prosecutorial experience while serving in the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office as a special prosecutor, where he tried misdemeanor and felony cases. And for his service as a special prosecutor, Justice Kelly was awarded the Outstanding Service to Milwaukee County Award in 2002. Justice Kelly headed the Appellate Practice Division of Reinhart Berner Van Duren, one of Wisconsin's premier law firms. He personally argued over a dozen cases before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, and the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. He also served as second chair on behalf of the University of Wisconsin student in a case before the United States Supreme Court. Justice Kelly has also been the vice president and general counsel of the Kern Family Foundation, one of Wisconsin's largest charitable organizations. As I said, he's a past president of the Milwaukee Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. In 2016, Justice Kelly was appointed to the Wisconsin Supreme Court by Governor Scott Walker. And today we are going to cover Justice Kelly's tenure on the court and his work as a justice and what went into that process. But before we get to your time on the court, Justice Kelly, can you tell us what brought you to Wisconsin?
Yeah, sure can. But before I do that, Matt, thanks so much for asking me to be a part of the presentation today. This is, I have to say, I miss getting together with the fine minds in the Federal Society. And this has to be a substitute for now, but I'm looking forward to when we can get together and actually have lunch together and spend time in each other's presence. But for now, it's gratifying to me that I can at least have a conversation with you all by this method. So I think I came to Wisconsin via the way most people do. I was born in Santa Barbara and grew up in Colorado and, you know, and came out here for college. I mean, this is how people do it, right? I say that somewhat glibly, but I'm deeply grateful for both Wisconsin and Wisconsinites and Carroll College, because as I was growing up, you know, I'm one of seven children, and you know, we always had everything that we needed as we were growing up, but we were not a wealthy family, and so when time came to consider what I would be doing with my future, and I had known for a long time that I wanted to go to college and law school, I knew it was going to require a substantial amount of financial help. And so as I was scouting around the different colleges I got a call from a recruiter from Carroll College who said she wanted to come out and meet with me. And so I did, and we sat down, and she put together a financial plan for me that made it actually possible for me to afford to go to college. And I was extraordinarily grateful for that and ended up at Carroll College and enjoyed my time there. One of the things I realized when I got there, there were an unusually high number of Coloradans at Carroll College, and I thought that was curious. And then I realized there were also a suspiciously large number of Floridians and Puerto Ricans. And then I figured out why that was so. The college recruiter, Carol Hilger, was absolutely brilliant. She loved to vacation in Colorado and Florida and Puerto Rico. And she structured her entire work year around going to those three places to recruit people to come to Carroll College. And so that's how I got to Carroll. There was a recruiter who loved to vacation in Colorado.
All right, so that answered what brought you to Wisconsin originally. But now, why did you decide to set up shop here and stay in Wisconsin for your career?
Yeah, the answer to that is actually pretty easy. I realized it actually pretty quickly after I got here. You know, when I decided to come out to Wisconsin for college, I'd never been here before. I didn't have any family here. I didn't know a soul here. And when I came out, one of the things she had told me is there was good fishing in Wisconsin. And I love fishing. And so I came out a few days early so I could camp and fish before I started studies. And ended up at Nagawicca Park in Waukesha County. As it turns out, I arrived on just a phenomenal weekend. It was so beautiful that all of Wisconsin happened to be there. They all wanted to camp that weekend. So the campsite was full. But I ended up, through one thing and another, sharing a campsite with a young family from Sheboygan Falls. They were the most remarkable couple, and they basically adopted me for the weekend, and they showed me what it was to be a Wisconsinite. And I came away from that weekend thinking that I had just had the most marvelous stroke of luck. I figured I'd met the most kind, generous, welcoming people in the entire state of Wisconsin. They had me for dinner. They took me sailing. We had lunch together. We spent the whole long weekend together. But then I realized a curious thing pretty quickly after that. I found people like that all over Wisconsin. I found them at school, and I found them at work. I found them at church. And I realized that this is what it means to be a Wisconsinite. Wisconsinites are the people of the open hand, generous heart. And I fell in love with them that first weekend I was here. So when it came time to start a family, there was no question where we were going to do that. It was definitely going to be here because we wanted our children to grow up in the community of fellow Wisconsinites.
I can vouch for that statement. I likewise am someone who came to Wisconsin in my adult life. I came from the nameless state to the south of us, but I can verify everything you're saying about Wisconsin and the people here is accurate. So let's talk about your early professional career. As I said in the introduction, you had two clerkships before you went into private practice, and I want to spend a little bit of time talking about your experience as a law clerk. So let's start with the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. Tell us who you clerked for and what that experience was like.
Yeah, I had a great fortune to clerk for Judge Ralph Adam Fine. As his name suggests, he's one of the finest jurists that I'd ever had the pleasure to come across. And that is so, I think, for a couple of different reasons. One, he just had a brilliant mind. To discuss law with him was to discuss the law with a master. And I loved doing that. And then two, He was a terrific mentor. So, you know, judges come in all different frames of mind and approaches when it comes to clerks. And some just set their clerks off and they, you know, they do what they do and they perform tasks. And for Ralph, though, he really saw this as an opportunity to form a young attorney and prepare them well for the practice of law. And so he was as much of a teacher to me as any of my law school professors, and a wise one at that. So there were, we could spend the rest of our time together this afternoon talking about all the lessons I learned from him. But just a couple of things, I learned the phrase, the term fly specking. I thought perhaps this was a Wisconsinite thing. I'd never come across this term in Colorado. And at first, what the heck is that? But such a wonderfully descriptive term, an apt term for a young attorney to learn from a judge about the incredible importance of attention to the minutest of detail. And he taught me both in words and in action and in the opinions that he would write, about how incredibly important it is to be precise in the application of the law. And that's true either as an advocate or as a jurist. The law is an authoritative command to us, telling us what is required of us. And Judge Fine understood that, you know, our constitutions and rule of law exist for the purpose of preserving and promoting our liberty. And so he would have nothing of broad sweeping principles and ideals and objectives in the law that he would then apply through his opinions. He understood that that because the law is an authoritative command, it must be read the way it was written and read precisely the way that it was written, so that people are able to adequately prepare and intelligently prepare and plan their affairs for the future, and without fear that some judge is going to come along at some point and take a nebulous and broad view of some statutory command and sweep them up into a position they never anticipated they would be in. So he was adamant about that precise application of the law. And the other, one of the other major lessons I learned from him was personal ownership of the work that you do. So one of the things that was that surprised me a little bit was the difference in the way Judge Fine and other judges would approach writing opinions. For Judge Fine, if it had his name on it, he was going to write every word. And the reason for that is because of that personal ownership. He understood that when that goes out into the public, he is answerable for every word that he writes. And he also understands that he would never put it this way because he was a modest man as well. But his knowledge of the law, the depth and breadth of his knowledge in the law could never be matched by a clerk. And so he wanted to make sure that he wrung any potential ambiguity or misunderstanding out of what he wrote so that the result was crisp and clear and precise and that it fit neatly within the existing canon of the law. And that's, you know, one of the ways that I thought of the opinions that I wrote while I was on the court was directly derived from what I learned from Ralph Adam Fine. So I picture the law as grand bookshelves filled with the law. And when we write an opinion, it's going to go somewhere in the shelves. It's going to exist adjacent to similar descriptions of the law. And when we pick up our opinion and we insert it into that bookcase, we want to make sure that it doesn't displace anything that the opinion does not precisely say that it displaces, and that it leaves everything else as intact as is humanly possible. And the only way you can do that well is if you have a broad knowledge where the opinion exists in that canon of law. And that's something I got from Ralph. And so, you know, I found from the very first opinion that I wrote on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, I felt like Ralph was looking over my shoulder and saying, make sure that you're precise. Make sure that you know how this is going to interact with all the rest of the canon of the law. And don't say something unless you know how it's going to interact with the rest of the canon. So that was my first clerkship. And then I went out to DC and I clerked for Rick Abell. He was in the Special Master's Office of the Court of Federal Claims. And he too was a delight to me and a mentor, a very brusque, rough and ready gentleman. I appreciated his approach to the law. He taught me the importance of a lively and an engaged mind. You know, a jurist doesn't rest on his laurels. He doesn't rest on his on the current state of his knowledge of the law. He doesn't rest on his assumptions about what the law ought to accomplish, but instead constantly has reference back to the authoritative documents that control the work that we do. Because no matter how smart we think we might be, it's really not our intelligence or our background or our principles or our philosophies that are the law. It is the law that is the law. It is separate and apart from us. And our responsibility is to apply it as written. And the reason that's our responsibility is because the law is given to us by our bosses, those who own the Constitution, the people of Wisconsin, the people of the United States. And when they speak authoritatively through their legislators what the law ought to be, it is our duty simply to obey and apply that law without respect to whether we like it or not. And Rick taught me the importance of constantly having reference back to those original authoritative documents in determining what those actually say, rather than what we might prefer that they say or want them to say. And then he also taught me the joy of writing. He had a vocabulary that was, what shall I say, extensive. And the more arcane the word, the more he loved it. And he would do everything he could to fill his opinions with the most obscure of words. And it was, and for him, it was an expression of love for the language, of its utility, of its flexibility, of its expressiveness. But he just took a great deal of joy in writing. And I've taken that from Rick, and that governed the work that I did on the court. Although I restrained my vocabulary, I think, more than he did. You know, he wrote for a very specialized bar, and you know, of course, on the Supreme Court, we write not just for the general bar, but for the general public. And one of the things that that I took from my experience on the court with respect to writing is the absolute importance of writing clearly, so that anybody in our state can pick up the work that we do and understand what we have said. Because what we're saying there is, this is how the law applies in this circumstance. And we expect people to know that, right? We say ignorance of the law is no excuse. And so I want to make sure that when I explain the law, that I've done it as clearly as I possibly can, so that you don't have to be a lawyer to pick up an opinion that I write and be able to understand it. And that, to me, is the joy of writing. And that's a direct consequence of my time with Ricky.
You touched on something I want to follow up on, which is your clerkship at the U.S. Court of Federal Claims is a specialized court. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals, obviously, a general court, general appeals from Milwaukee County cases. Can you talk about the difference between working at general state court of appeals and a specialized court? Very few lawyers are going to wind up appearing before the U.S. Court of Federal Claims. We all can understand what the Wisconsin Court of Appeals does. Why don't you tell us about the distinction between the court and the types of cases you had at the Federal Court of Claims and how it was different being a specialized law clerk for a law clerk for a specialized court and a law clerk at a general court.
Yeah, so yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, clerking for rec was being on a specialized part of a specialized bar. So the jurisdiction of the Court of Federal Claims is entirely statutorily provided. And the office that I was in, the Office of Special Masters, we were dealing solely with vaccine injuries. And so it was hyper-specialized. Now, the consequence of that is that the attorneys that appeared before us had a generally speaking, a depth of knowledge of the subject matter that we were dealing with that was truly impressive. Because a number of the attorneys, that was the entirety of their practice. They did vaccine injuries and nothing else. And so they dealt with a fairly small statutory universe, but they knew it exceedingly well. And that was helpful to us, of course, because, you know, we didn't have to do quite as much original research. The opinions that we wrote naturally had a much narrower reach, and so there wasn't as much of concern about how it might affect the broader canon of the law. On the Court of Appeals, of course, you know, that's a court of general jurisdiction, and so any case that could be brought in a circuit court in Wisconsin could wind up at the Court of Appeals. And as a consequence, the cases that we addressed were as diverse as the subjects in the law. And we had to be prepared to deal with them, each one of them, as accurately as any other. And that put a little bit more impetus on us to do research just in case the attorneys who were representing the parties had not worked their way down to the nth degree that we needed before an opinion could be written and then published. So when you're on clerking at a court of with general jurisdiction, your workload is substantially greater in terms of research and knowing the breadth of the law, in addition to the depth of the individual issue you're specifically writing about.
I'm going to turn to your career in private practice, but before I do that, I just want to send a reminder out to our audience. If you have questions for Justice Kelly, please just click on the Q&A function on the bottom of the screen, type it in, and I'll try to get to as many of them as possible. Tell us about the types of cases and the type of law you practiced while in private practice.
Yeah, so I spent most of my career at Reinhardt Berner Van Duren, at the risk of undue flattery, I enjoyed my time there immensely. One of the reasons I was excited to go there is because I knew that I'd be practicing with some really accomplished attorneys, and as you guys probably know, there's a Scottish maxim that says that some things are better felt than telt. I think that describes to a large extent how we learn to practice law. You know, we go to law school, we get a few ideas, we get those down pat. You graduate, you walk into your first case and you go, well, I wasn't really prepared by law school to handle this soup to nuts. It's a profession that we hand down from generation to generation. And it's really dependent on attorneys who are willing to act as mentors. And so when I went to Reinhardt, that was what I was looking forward to. That was my expectation. And I was not disappointed. Just outstanding practitioners there who are willing to pour into a young attorney to make sure that they are able to competently practice the law. Now, I was I spent my career before the court in litigation, which I loved for a few different reasons. One, I've been told by others that I tend to have something of a pugilistic nature, and litigation satisfies that. But two, there's also I think there's a diversity in breadth in practicing litigation that that I'm not sure you can find elsewhere. You never can tell what issues you might be addressing on Friday when you walk into the office on Monday. I mean, you just can't tell. So my practice was broadly commercial, but it was fairly broad within that realm of commercial law. So I dealt with contracts and real estate and banking, did some election-related matters in constitutional cases on the side. But generally it was, if there was a dispute between companies over a commercial matter or between an individual and a company, it was potential that I'd be dealing with that. And I loved that because it kept the practice of law just endlessly fascinating. It was really impossible to become bored with that. Now, I know that these days the trend is towards more and more focused practice groups and practice areas, and drill down and obtain really deep and comprehensive knowledge of a particular area of the law. And there are benefits to that. But I think there's also a danger there that that you lose the joy of addressing a wide range of issues.
Can you tell us a few career highlights or favorite memories of yours without obviously divulging anything you can't divulge, but maybe you could tell us, audience, of some of your favorite cases that you worked on?
Yeah, that's all hidden behind the attorney-client privilege. I can't say a thing. I think the perhaps in one of the suite of cases that I enjoyed the most, and demonstrate how diverse it can be, was a suite of cases that I litigated on behalf of the developer of the Bayshore Mall. So there were lease issues, there were land use issues, there were condemnation issues, and we were able to handle all of those. And one of those issues was one of my tickets to the Wisconsin Supreme Court to present an argument there. There was a question about who gets the interest that accrues on a large condemnation award that's held in a clerk's office. And it had never been addressed before. Nobody knew. We took that to the Supreme Court. It was our position that the developer got it because of the underlying award belonged to him. And fortunately, the Supreme Court agreed unanimously, I might add. But that was, I loved working on those cases. Again, one, because there were such a wide range of issues that we addressed. Two, brought me to the Supreme Court. And then three, ended up paving the way for the creation of something that has a great deal of value. It was just a pleasure to see the actual outcome of those cases. You can go and you can actually stand at Bayshore Town Center and see what was accomplished with that. And that's one of the and I think sometimes this is a great urge that I had during my practice of law, was to see the practical outcomes of what we do. We can easily get lost in our own heads and we just live there entirely with the legal questions that we are struggling with. We get done with our work at the end of the day and, you stand up and your office looks an awful lot like it did when you came in. And day after day, it still looks the same. And it's oftentimes difficult to see the practical effect of what you do. And I loved seeing, that there is something that follows from the work that we do. It has real world consequences that are really important. People are able to exercise their liberties, their property rights are protected, and then they do something with that, right? So, with that Bayshore suite of cases, what they did with their property rights was create an outstanding town center that is being enjoyed by people, not just in Glendale, but all over Southeast Wisconsin. And so it's very gratifying to see that kind of result come from the work that you do.
Let's turn now to your next act, being a judge. When did you first start thinking about a desire to become a judge, or did you have that inkling that you might want to go on the bench someday?
Yeah, that's relatively recent, actually. Oddly enough, shortly after I graduated from law school, my wife turned to me one day and said, "You know what? I think you'd be a good judge." And I thought, well, that's quite a compliment for my wife. That's wonderful. And I told her so, and I said, "But you know, I want to be involved in day-to-day litigation, being involved in the cases as they happen. I want to be in the midst of that." And I saw being on the bench as being removed from it. And so I said, I don't think that's for me. But then every few years, every once in a while, she would turn to me and say, "You know, I think you'd be a good judge." And one of those times was about 10 years ago. Right about when she was saying that, there was an appointment opportunity to the Court of Appeals in District 2. So we prayed about that. We sought the counsel of friends and colleagues. And I decided somewhat reluctantly that I would apply. And primarily, I was later told that this was perhaps not the best way to approach something like this. But I applied because I thought the governor ought to have an opportunity to appoint someone who has a constitutional textualist view of how we do the law. I was not going to presume to say that I was the best person to do that. There were other outstanding applicants for that field. But I figured, I would make myself available. And then if the governor wished to appoint me, he certainly could. Well, I went through that process. It was a long process. And the governor appointed Mark Gundrum. And I think he did a very good thing in appointing Mark Gundrum. He's an outstanding judge, and I'm glad he's on the Court of Appeals. He's done great work there. But that was the initial inkling that perhaps I would eventually go that direction. And it started a germ of thought in the back of my head that would not leave me alone. And over time, it grew and it grew until the vacancy occurred on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Oddly enough, I had not thought of that as an appointment opportunity for myself. A few of my friends and I had been trying to get Mike Brennan back on the court. We really wanted him. He'd been such an outstanding state circuit court judge. We really wanted him to be on the Supreme Court. And so when I heard that Justice Prosser was going to be retiring, within 5 minutes, I was on the phone with Mike Brennan. And I was encouraging him to apply. So eventually, of course, he decided not to, and it was only then that people started asking me if I'd be willing to go through the appointment process. And again, we prayed about it as a family with friends and colleagues. We sought their advice and their input, and we decided that was something that we would pursue. So that was that in itself was a fascinating jury. Not the least because I looked at the others who had applied for a potential appointment, and I thought, well, gee golly, these are really good practitioners, really good judges, and I felt like a bit of an outsider in that because I had such respect for the others who had submitted their names. And so it was a little bit of a surprise, a pleasant one, of course, when I was appointed. So it's been about, I guess it was about 10 years ago when the thought started germinating, and it eventually ended up 4 years ago with the appointment to the Supreme Court.
So many Supreme Court justices, not most of them, have been judges in their prior career. You came from private practice to the state's Supreme Court. So you weren't transitioning from one court level to another, but from one profession to another. What was it like your first term on the court to have to make that switch from an advocate and a practitioner to someone who's deciding the cases?
So after I was appointed, I was wondering that myself, you know, in the run up to taking the first case, what is that going to be like? Because obviously the roles are, and the impetus for what we do is completely different, right? So as an advocate, you are looking for a win for your client within the boundaries of the law. And as a jurist, that's not what you're doing at all. You are looking for what does the law require? And then we will apply it to this case, and which side wins or which side loses is not does not come into the consideration. It is simply the question of what does the law require. But I think that when that thought started germinating 10 years ago about potentially serving on the court, I think that was gradually preparing me to make that transition. I've always loved the scholastic aspect of the law. To me, it is just an absolutely beautiful, complicated, fascinating puzzle. And it's something that you are there to put together. And it's just a wonderful intellectual exercise to do that. And over the last 10 years, I had found myself being drawn more and more to that aspect of the law, simply as an intellectual and a scholastic question. And so when I eventually came to the Supreme Court, I think that that served me well, because it was really the culmination, I think, of the journey that I'd been on. So it wasn't actually that difficult to take off the advocacy hat and then simply look at the law the way it's written, with no desire other than to be accurate and precise in the way that I applied it to the cases that came before us. So I just as an evolutionary matter, I think I was being prepared for several years before I arrived. But then, having arrived in that first term, I was just ecstatic about performing the role of a jurist, with an understanding that my days were going to be filled with reading cases and statutes and briefs and little else other than that. And in fact, some friends had asked me before I went through the appointment process, they asked me if this was really something that I was sure I wanted to do, because they told me, your days are going to be very, very different. You're going to be in your chambers and you're going to see no one for days and weeks and months. And all you'll have is the briefs and your books around you, and that will be your life. And I had a huge grin on my face, and I was waiting for them to tell me what the downside was. So this works out. This works out well. I am by nature an introvert, and by that I mean that I get energy from being alone. And if I can be alone with my books, that is a splendid day.
It's a feature, not a bug, of the job.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So we have some audience questions trickling in. I'm going to get to a few of them. One question is, how did you maintain collegiality with the other justices who did not share your judicial philosophy?
Yeah, there's something I learned a long time ago, really in the beginning of my practice, when I realized that there are people who will come to you and want to be adverse to you because of your politics, because of your philosophical commitments, or something to that effect. And one of the things I decided early on was that I would treat them the way that the Bible has taught me to treat others, to walk humbly, to love unconditionally, and to speak the soft word that turns away wrath. And so you know, I came to my colleagues with that understanding, that I would be humble before them, that I would love them unconditionally, and that I would speak to them in words that I would be confident that, you know, if God himself were listening in, he would have no disapproval. And what I found as a result of that is that they responded in kind. And I had an outstanding working relationship with all of the members of the court. In fact, one of the first jurists to come and greet me in my chambers was Justice Abrahamson. And she told me that we were going to disagree a lot, but that if I did not pressure her for a vote, we would get along just fine. And that started out our working relationship, and I found her to be a very intelligent woman and an accomplished jurist. And we did disagree a lot, but it was always in a collegial fashion. And I enjoyed the back and forth that we had as we discussed the law in the cases. And I think that having someone to talk with who comes to the law from a very different perspective was actually beneficial to me. It sharpened my analysis and kept me honest, making sure that I wasn't stealing any intellectual bases in writing opinions. So as a consequence, it was really, I think, a very good atmosphere in which to work.
Another audience question is, what impressed you about the internal workings of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and what disappointed you?
I think, I came to the court after Chief Justice Pat Robinsack was Chief Justice. And so there had been a number of reforms in internal operating procedure before I got there, and I was impressed by how smoothly it worked. I know that prior to the chief's tenure, that cases tended to stack up towards the end of the term, and there'd be all out sprint and flurry of work late into the night, sometime all night long, trying to get out mandates by the deadline, June 30th. And so I'd heard those stories. And so my first term, I was, as we were approaching the end of the term, I kind of mentally started preparing for that kind of crush of work. But given the procedures that we had in place, we actually coasted into the final days in good form. I think my first term, the first court term I was there, I think we only had a few opinions that were mandated on the last day of the term. So I think just internal procedures worked much more smoothly than I had expected. As far as disappointment, it's hard for me to actually point to anything on that score. I loved being there, and I think that colored an awful lot of how I saw the court's function. One of the things I would have preferred had to do with oral arguments. So we had, we have the clock, and Matt, this well. You just saw it yesterday. You've got the red light, the green light, the yellow light, and we stuck to that pretty darn carefully. And I suspect they are doing so this term as well. But sometimes, you know, cases present issues that justify having a little more conversation. And, you know, I would have liked, when it was warranted by the specific case, to have the freedom to go beyond that set time and question the attorneys further. I always found oral arguments to be very helpful, either in tying up loose ends or elucidating new avenues of analysis that I had not thought of. And so I went into arguments really wanting to hear what the attorneys had to say about the cases. And sometimes we would wrap up before I was satisfied that we have explored all of the potential permutations of the analysis. So I would have liked to have seen a little more flexibility there.
You have had two clerkships in your career, as we talked about earlier. Can you tell us about how you utilized law clerks as a Supreme Court justice, what you looked for in law clerks, what the hiring process was? I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so that was the way that that I worked with clerks was profoundly influenced both by Ralph Adam Fine and Ricky Bell. So what I drew from Ralph is, ownership of the work that has your name on it. So I would have, my clerks would write a first draft of opinions, but I considered that a point of departure. So my first draft would follow theirs, but quite often it would be entirely different. Not because they didn't do a good job of doing the analysis, not because they were wrong, not because they had not done as I had asked, but because if it has my name on it, it has to be my voice and it has to be my analysis. And if I were ever called on the carpet after having released an opinion to explain my opinion, I don't want to have to go to my clerk and say, okay, so what did we mean when we said this? That is something that I need to defend. And then I took from Ralph that having a little bit more experience than my clerks, it was up to me to make sure that not only was the analysis exactly right, but that it is done in such a way that that can be easily understood by our bosses, the people of Wisconsin, and that when we put that on the bookshelf, that it does not unnecessarily disturb any other part of the canon, but for what we had specifically said in the opinion. And so I was influenced in that regard, certainly by Ralph and the way that I worked with our clerks. But beyond that, and this kind of goes into what I look for when I hired clerks. So I want someone who's got a bright and lively mind. I want someone who's exhibited a love of the law, not just looking for a credential to put on their resume, but who genuinely has come to the law because they are fascinated by it, because they understand its inherent significance, because they understand the power that it has if we follow the law to keep us free, so that we may live together in peace and in productivity. I want to see that, at least the seeds of that, in a clerk. And of course, I want someone who's a good student and a good writer. And I also want someone who has an outstanding character, and that means an awful lot to me. The things that we work on in conference, those are confidential until the confidence is never broken except for what comes out in an opinion. And I want to be confident that the clerks that I hire will keep those confidences, that it is part of their nature to keep the confidence. Not that it's a code of ethics that is imposed on them, but they truly understand the significance of keeping that confidence. And so I look for good character. And I also look for someone that I think I would enjoy working with. You know, we spend a lot of time together, and you know, and I want this to be, you know, it's going to be a pleasant experience for me one way or the other, because, you know, I was the justice, and so there's just a lot that goes along with that. But I wanted it to be an enjoyable experience for them as well. And then, you know, again, influenced by both Rick and Ralph, I wanted it to be a learning experience for them. And in that regard, I'm hopeful that that I served as a mentor for my clerks as they came through, and that they came away from the experience not only having picked up some scholastic education, but practical, and learning from someone who's just a little bit ahead of them in legal profession. And so so hopefully I was able to be a mentor to them as well. But that's what I look for in working with my clerks, and kind of the things I was looking for when I would hire them.
When you tried to persuade a colleague to join a position you were taking, when was the best time to do that? Before the case is argued, during oral argument, through the questions you're asking, decision conference, opinion drafting, maybe all the above. But I'd like you to talk about how you found it most effective to try to persuade your colleagues of a point you were making.
Yeah, so I'll start with this little known fact. Jurists are people too. And they bring along all of the human aspects that we normally exhibit in every other aspect of our lives. And so I always found it to be more helpful when we discussed a case early on, as we're working our way through how to frame the issues, how to think about the issues that are presented in the case, even before we get to the specific analysis of it. Right. So we want to locate the issue in the broad canon of the law. Where are we at generally? That can actually be a contested issue. So locating it in the proper area oftentimes will drive to a particular type of conclusion. So I think it's important to, you know, to have a certain amount of flexibility, you know, when you're considering those initial early on questions, so you don't tie yourself into a pathway that later is hard to get out of. Because once, and this is just a human thing, you know, I think it's true of jurists just as anyone else. Once you start your analysis and you start going down that path, you get more and more bought into that analysis the further you go. And so the longer that goes, the more difficult it's going to be to get a person to change their mind and decide to go down a different analytical path. So, you know, one of the things that that I did when I was there is, you know, I told my colleagues that I was going to be in the conference room at 9 o'clock on days before, you know, on days we had oral argument. I'd be there at 9 o'clock. And if anyone wanted to come down and talk about the cases that we were going to hear that day, feel free to come on down and we'll talk about them. And I love that. I don't know that I changed anyone's mind in those conversations. And that was not my purpose in that. My purpose was to get a sense of where they were at, get a sense of whether there's anything that I was missing, perhaps suggest a few things that maybe they might not have thought of, but mostly to have a collegial and interesting discussion about the cases we were about to hear. You know, and of course the Supreme Court taking only the cases that it wishes to hear, we have a tendency to veer towards the more interesting of them, right? So most of the cases that we took, we thought they were interesting. And I love, you know this, Matt, and others do as well. I love talking about the law. I find it endlessly fascinating. And so when I can have an opportunity to talk about the law with some really really bright folks, I'll jump on that every time. But I think it had the side benefit of, you know, if people were uncertain about where they were going to go with their analysis, that was an opportunity to do a little bit of spitballing and perhaps, you know, perhaps bring up some thoughts and ideas that had not already been considered. But I think, generally speaking, earlier on in the process, if you're trying to convince a colleague to go a particular direction, earlier the better.
Justice Kelly, we are pushing up against our hour here, so I want to wrap up with a final question. Could you tell our audience what you're up to these days, what you might be up to in the future?
Sure. Well, I'm currently the Senior Fellow in Constitutional Governance at the Institute for Reform in Government, an organization recently started by C.J. Safer, a friend of many of us, outstanding organization concentrated on policies that promote liberty and limited government and market-based ideas. And it's my pleasure, my part in this is the executive oversight program. So we will be developing white papers, information, and proposing that the legislature exercise its oversight function towards the purpose of making sure that the executive branch is complying with the statutes the legislature has passed and looking for information to inform their decisions on potential future policies. So that's what I'm doing now. I'm also at the request of colleagues and friends and family who have asked me to consider this. I am seriously considering running for the Court of Appeals seat in District 2 that is up this coming April. So not many months from now. So I will be making a decision on that, I'm sure probably within the next week or so, but we are seriously looking at that possibility.
Well, Justice Kelly, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. It was a pleasure. Thanks for your commitment to the chapter and everything you've done. And I wish you nothing but the best. And I hope this was as enlightening for the audience members as it was for me.
Matt, thank you so much. This has been just an absolute joy. I really appreciate this time with all of you guys.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Until our next event, we are adjourned.